Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Hi, I'm Larry Mueller, and today we zero in on native prairie plants and using them in our Wisconsin landscape. Neil Diebold, prairie ecologist, landscape designer, president of Prairie Nursery in Westfield, Wisconsin, our guest once again to talk with us about prairie plants. And certainly, if you want to join in with your questions, you're welcome to do that. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. Or in Madison, reach us at 263-1890. Give a call. We'll be glad to get you on the air. Neil, welcome back.
Thanks, Larry. Great to be back.
I've got a copy of your catalog for 2007 in front of me, and the cover is just absolutely gorgeous.
That's a dry prairie in Winchester, Wisconsin, that actually I planted myself about 17 years ago. And
boy,
it's on dry, sandy soil, and it's amazing what you can do when you pick the right plants to match the soil conditions and the growing conditions. You can just create fantastic native landscapes.
And it stays colorful like that for a long time.
Basically from late spring all the way into the fall and even in the winter with the prairie grasses, which give you that fall color and,
yeah,
and good winter color too. So it's really a four-season landscape.
Oh, man. Can anybody get their hands on this catalog, by the way?
They can. In fact, they don't even have to pay anything for it. They can just call us up at 1-800-476-9453. Or they can go online at www.prairienursery.com, and you can order a catalog there as well. And, of course, you can just check out the website because everything that's on the catalog and more is listed on the website.
All right, super. Well, I'll tell you what, we've got Sherry in Port Wing with a question, so let's go right to Sherry. Hi, thank you for calling.
Well, thank you. I'm sorry my question is not about prairie planting, but our guest is a landscaper. And so my question is, I'm so delighted. My landlord recently gave me permission to dig up an area of their very precious lawn for vegetable and flower garden. I have two mature ornamental cedar trees, and my question is twofold. One, why does snow melt around cedar trees much faster than any other type of tree? And two, how close to the surface are their roots, and how close to the cedar trees can I till the ground without hurting the trees?
Okay, I assume these are white cedar trees as opposed to red cedars. Is that correct?
I would imagine.
Okay.
They're very tall and very narrow.
Okay, and they have kind of flat needles?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. It may be that you're not actually seeing the snow melt faster, but perhaps there's less snow under the trees to start with because the needles will shed the snow to the side.
Mm-hmm.
That may be a possibility. You'll see that under pines, spruces, and other conifers like cedar. So it may actually not have been that much snow to start with. And the roots on white cedars tend to be very superficial, so you really want to minimize or not even till underneath there. And I don't know how many, if you're planning on putting vegetable plants under the tree, is that correct?
Well, there's no under because these are very upright and narrow.
Oh, yeah. So you have very little shade below them.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so you have plenty of sun to grow your vegetables.
Yeah.
Okay.
And in terms of prairie plants, or any plants for that matter, it's not a good idea to plant under trees?
Generally not. In fact, when we design a prairie, we typically will not include trees for a number of reasons. One is that prairie plants, for the vast majority, like at least a half a day of full sun. And when you get a mature tree, whether it's a conifer or a deciduous tree, it's going to shade it too much for most of those plants to do well. Secondly, birds perch in trees, and they eat seeds of wonderful plants like buckthorn and honeysuckle, and they will poop those little seeds right underneath the tree, and then you've got a war with the invasives. And thirdly, we generally manage our prairies with burning. You can use mowing as an alternative, but for people that want to burn their prairies, most trees are not really fire-resistant. The exceptions are trees like the bur oak, the shagbark hickory, white oak to a certain degree, and you can maybe include like one or two trees, depending on the size of the prairie, for accent in your prairie. But underneath that, you'll probably end up having to plant different types of plants in the long term once those trees start to mature.
All right. Thanks, Sherry. Ron and Arena, your turn now. Hi, Ron.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for having the program.
Sure.
I've got a question. I've got an area. I've just got a lot in town. It's a real big lot. And it's, of course, it's arena sand. And in the back corner, I would like to plant some prairie smoke. And is that a, you know, sandburrs are a real issue, you know, as far as keeping ahead of them in arena if you've got some barren spots. How aggressive of a grower is, like, prairie smoke?
Okay, prairie smoke.
And,
oh, sorry, go ahead.
And then what time of the year would I be able to plant, or how soon can I plant it this spring?
What spring?
Yeah, what spring?
I read it wasn't available from your nursery last fall.
Yeah. You can plant that. We have plenty of those available. You can plant that this spring. Really, as soon as as soon as it warms up, if it ever does, probably by the end of the month, you shouldn't have any problem with that.
Yeah. And, does it grow quite aggressively once you put it in then, or is it a, I know all prairie plants grow slow.
Yeah.
But it's not just looking at competition from the sandburrs, so I realize how many plants I should get to fill in an area.
You bet. It's a perfect choice for your dry sand. It will do very well, but it's not a super aggressive plant. It creeps very slowly by stolons,
mm-hmm.
little root stolons that come off to the side. And you probably would want to plant them about a foot on center, and after about 2 or 3 years, they should fill in to form a nice thick carpet.
Okay.
But in the meantime, you will have sandburrs between those plants unless you put some kind of a mulch down.
Would they eventually crowd sandburrs out?
Typically, yes, although maybe you might have a couple here and there in areas that haven't completely filled in.
Yeah, I can identify a sandburr pretty easy because that just grows like crazy.
Oh, yeah. And if you don't see it, you'll feel it.
Yeah, that's for sure.
No, I don't let them get to that point.
Oh, good.
The other question I had is, again, on the same thing, is you have like an ornamental garden that you have, or like a flower beds. Again, you plant those as early as possible in the spring?
Yeah, spring is the best time for most transplanting. Reason being is if you plant in the fall, and fall is not bad, but you tend to have a higher risk of winter damage when you plant transplants in the fall.
Mm-hmm.
And if you do put plants in the fall, we recommend you put 3 to 5 inches of clean straw mulch over them after things really freeze and the plants go dormant. Mm-hmm. So let's say you put your transplants in September or October. Let them grow for a while, and then November, December, when things really start to get cold and the plants go dormant, you put 3 to 5 inches of clean straw mulch over them, and then you take the mulch off in the spring and leave maybe a couple inches around the plants, maybe 3 inches around mm-hmm. the plants, to help keep weeds down and hold in moisture.
All right. Good luck. Thanks a lot, Ron, for calling. And let's go to Claire in Grafton next. Hi, Claire.
Hello. I've been watching some huge earth-moving equipment along I-43 in Grafton, clearing about 40 acres for some development. And the thought crossed my mind, when prairie plants came in after the glaciers left, they didn't have a lot of topsoil to establish in. In fact, they created the deep topsoils in the prairie country. I'm wondering if there's been any experimentation of planting in a scraped-off area. There would be no weed competition to start with, and I wonder what species would do well in really poor, denuded kind of glacial till or soils.
Claire, you have called the right place.
All right.
Because I used to manage the University of Wisconsin-Green Bay Arboretum, and we had a project in 1980, we expanded a pond and we dug out all this fabulous red clay from the Valders glaciation, which is that gunky, horrible, red, nasty clay.
Mm.
And we had this subsoil clay, no topsoil, no organic matter. And I planted about 50 different species of prairie plants on that. And I actually, one half I put mulch, straw mulch, about 2 inches thick to hold the moisture in, and one half no mulch. And we were able to track the progress of the different species. And if you look in our catalog, you'll see a section called Clay Busters. And those plants were largely the result of that experiment. And if you do this, you do have the benefit of reduced weeds, but you are going to have very difficult growing conditions, and the plants will grow very slowly. But if you select those heavy-duty clay buster plants, you can typically have very good results with them, but mulching is strongly recommended with a couple inches of clean straw mulch to help hold the moisture in, because moisture is critical. And if you can irrigate it for the first couple months, let's say you plant it in May, if you can irrigate mm-hmm. it for the first 60 days, that will make a tremendous difference in your germination and seedling survival. Now, similarly on sandy soils, oftentimes you uncover sandy soils and you have no weeds. And by picking the right plants, in this case plants for dry sandy soils, you can have tremendous results. The only exception to this is when you get down to what you would call like lake bed sand or white sand, which has essentially no nutrition in it. then you're in a situation where there's almost nothing that will grow plants and you've got a sand dune. And that's where you might have to add some organic matter, fertilizer, et cetera. Organic matter is better because it's a longer-term solution than just putting fertilizer on there. But on your situation, I'm assuming it's kind of a till clay type soil. Is that correct, Claire?
Just theoretically. I'm wondering if my question was whether you could develop that land, you know, in a development situation. Instead of putting sod, you could just immediately start a prairie.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. But follow those.
The wave of the future.
Right. Well, pick the right plants, like the clay busters, assuming it's a heavy clay, and then put a couple inches of straw mulch on it after you seed it, and you'll be amazed at the results.
All right. Thank you.
You bet. Right. Good luck.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Neil Diebold, our guest today, prairie ecologist and landscape designer and president of Prairie Nursery of Westfield, Wisconsin. Question about prairie plants, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. Or if you're in the Madison area, reach us at 263-1890. Let's go to Linda in La Crosse next. Linda, hi to you. Thanks for calling.
Hi, and thanks for taking my question.
Sure.
We're building a cabin on the south shore of Lake Superior, and we want to keep the land around us in a very natural state, and we just don't know a whole lot about what type of plants would work well. We have a sandy loam and some of that red clay, but mostly sandy loam, and we're looking to find something that's dwarf grasses and not a real tall prairie look, but a shorter look that would look natural and that we wouldn't have to cut it.
Okay. You may want to consider a turf mix that we developed. It's called No-Mow Lawn.
Oh, that sounds wonderful.
Yeah, it really is, I have to tell you. And it's composed of six different fine fescue grasses. Now, where you're going to be on the south shore of Lake Michigan is not an optimal situation for planting a prairie because you have the cooler lake temperatures.
Yes.
And also, in those areas where you do have red clay, the clay tends to hold a lot of moisture. It's a very cold soil. It doesn't warm up fast in the spring. And most of your prairie flowers and grasses are what we call warm season plants. Mm. And they do not do well in those conditions because spring to those soils won't come until June or July, and they'd have almost no growing season. So the fescues in our No-Mow Lawn mix are cool season grasses, and they will thrive under cooler growing conditions, whether it's clay, sandy loam, or whatever. But when you get up that far north, there's not a lot of places where prairie will grow except on real sunny, sandy soils. In fact, there's big bluestem growing on the very tip of Wisconsin in, I believe it's the Bad River Indian Reservation.
Yeah, there's a lot of the lupin growing wild everywhere, and I want to encourage that. But maybe I can mix in some of the it's a turf mix?
Yeah, it's called our No-Mow Lawn Mix.
Okay.
It works really well. Some people, if you want a more manicured look, people mow it at about 4 inches about every month instead of every 10 days. Okay, and I use it in my yard. I mow it a couple times a year. I have areas that I haven't mowed for 3 or 4 years. Now, it does get taller in the sun. It will send up a flower stalk that gets about knee-high. But if I want that to look a little bit nicer when the flower stalk comes up, usually early to mid-June, I just go and mow it back to about 4 or 5 inches, and then it stays at that level, 5-6 inches, for the rest of the season.
And what's your website?
It's www.prairienursery, P-R-A-I-R-I-E, nursery.com.
Okay. Oh, yeah. I did one. I think I spelled it wrong, and I got baby supplies.
Nah.
Oh, yeah. That's our other company?
Thanks a lot, Linda.
Thank you.
Good luck.
Appreciate it. Good luck. Edward in McQuanago, it's your turn next. Hi.
Good morning. How are you?
Good. Great. Thanks for calling.
Listen, I have a question about burning a prairie. I've got a quarter to a half acre of prairie that is about 10 years old, and I'm putting in a little more. I've always burned in the spring, every 2 or 3 years. And I've been told that if you burn in the spring, it favors either the flowers or the grasses, as opposed to the fall favoring either flowers or grasses. And I can't remember which is which.
Okay, typically.
Is that true?
Well, it depends. Fire is a tool that can be used in many different ways. And what you'll find is we use it in spring burning to control cool season grasses and weeds, cool season grasses such as quackgrass, bromegrass, and in fact in the prairie, bluegrass, your typical lawn bluegrass, is a weed because it's an undesirable member of that community. So what we do is we wait until usually, well, in a normal year, about mid-April, like maybe this weekend in a quote-unquote normal year, but when the buds of the sugar maple tree are just opening and breaking, that's the best time to burn to control cool season weeds and grasses. This year, that'll probably be about, oh, May 15th instead of April 15th.
Or June 15th,
yeah, if you live any farther north. But that timing is really essential to controlling the cool season plants. But some of your cool season prairie plants, like your yellow coneflower, your bergamot, et cetera, are already up and growing and will be slightly damaged by that, but proportionally not that damaged. But what will happen when you do that on a regular basis is that you will favor the warm season flowers and grasses, which are the majority of the species in the prairie, and it will tend to favor the grasses over some of the cool season flowers. So some people will occasionally do a fall burn, which is a little more neutral because you're not selecting against the cool season species. Mm-hmm. So a fall burn, people will say, well, you get more flowers with a fall burn than a spring burn. But in fact, it's really more of a neutral thing. It kind of keeps it a level playing field. But it will not give you the benefit or much benefit in controlling cool season weeds and grasses like a mid to late spring burn will do.
Okay. I see. One year I did burn a little bit late, mm-hmm. and some of the flowers and grasses were emerging a little bit, and it did seem to inhibit them a little bit. It set them back and perhaps limited the bloom?
It could very well be the case, although I've seen situations where it has no effect, or sometimes even though it appears as though here you have these prairie flowers 2-3 inches tall and you burn them, by June or July or August when they're blooming, you can't even tell the difference hardly. So it does depend on the year, other factors, when did the rainfall come, and so on and so forth, that will influence your actual bloom. But the later you burn, the more proportional damage you're going to do to the prairie flowers and grasses. And when I say late, I mean when you're getting into May.
Mm-hmm. Okay. But it's not too late now.
Oh, goodness, no. In fact, it's a little bit. It's just about the next couple of weeks are going to be when you want to burn. Usually the last 2 weeks in April are when we would burn in southern Wisconsin on a quote-unquote normal year.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thanks very much for calling. Neil Deball, our guest today, president of Prairie Nursery of Westfield, Wisconsin. I'm Larry Mueller, Jim Packard, our producer, on Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we have one open line, so you can give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. David in Fond du Lac, you are next. Thanks for calling.
Good morning. Thank you for taking from my call.
Sure.
I've got a small woodland, urban woodland lot in the city that I've planted a portion of it to sweet jewel pie weed, which Prairie Nursery has gracefully sent to me 3 times now, and I still can't get it established, and I'm wondering what I'm doing wrong.
Well, that's a good question. What kind of soil do you have there?
It's a mixed soil, but it's mostly underlined with heavy clay, red clay.
Red clay. How much topsoil do you have over that red clay there?
I would say 4 to 8 inches.
Okay. It's not a dry site by any stretch, is it? Is it?
No, it's a relatively wet site, for an urban site anyways.
You know, it may be too wet.
And
normally when you think of the Joe Pye weeds, like the regular Joe Pye weed, Eupatorium maculatum, or the tall Joe Pye weed, Eupatorium fistulosum, you think wet.
That's why I planted it there, that and the fact that it blooms later in the year, and it's hard to get flowers in a woodland plant in the summertime.
Yeah, the sweet Joe Pye weed is an exception to the rule of planting Joe Pye weeds in moist soil. It likes a better drained medium soil, like a good loamy soil, or your soil would be fine if it was just a little bit better drained. It grows in upland woodlands.
Okay.
Where you'll find it. So you might want to try something different in that situation.
I'll do that.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you for your time.
You bet. Good luck.
Thanks for calling. And Bob and Gilman, we turn to you now. Hi, Bob.
Hi, good morning to both of you.
Morning.
Morning.
I have way too much lawn, and I'd like to turn some of it into prairie if I can. I'm just wondering how much preparation is needed from turning a good sod lawn into land that would grow some prairie plants.
Okay. There are many ways you can approach this. The first question you want to ask is the site level or is it sloping? Is there any danger of erosion on the site?
No erosion at all.
Okay. Are you willing to use herbicides or would you prefer not to?
Well, it wouldn't matter one way or the other.
Okay. The easiest, simplest way to convert a nice lawn into a nicer prairie... I'm not prejudiced. The easiest way is to Kill it with just straight Roundup.
Uh-huh.
Okay, do you have any weeds or other grasses in your lawn? Is there quackgrass or anything else in there? Or is it
not much quack, but there's some creeping Charlie, and there's quite a few dandelions.
Okay. Do you mind if you look at a brown spot for one summer?
No, uh-uh.
Okay. I had a little, a disagreement at home where my long-suffering spouse equivalent said that she didn't really like the former lawn being brown all summer. And I said, dear, brown is a color, too.
But just, easy maintenance, too, right?
Yeah, really low maintenance. Hey, it's, you know, you can go out. I said, look, I could go out there and mow that every 2 weeks, or I can spray it every 2 months.
Yeah.
Okay, what would you prefer? For me, from my standpoint, it's a lot less maintenance. But anyway, this way, you're probably going to have to go out there and spray it with Roundup like 3 times.
Okay.
Every about 6 to 8 weeks. So wait until your lawn is growing up about 3, 4, maybe 5 inches in the spring.
Uh-huh.
And then spray it once with Roundup. And then just let everything die back. And typically, the weeds may not be all completely killed. So let whatever weeds come up, and hit them again in about 8 weeks. And do this 3, maybe 4 times.
Okay.
Then by fall, October, November, everything should be completely dead. And then rather than go and till that up, if you've ever tilled up freshly killed sod, actually this won't be freshly killed, but the one thing you don't want to do is spray it and till it, because I did this once. Oh my God. First of all, the rototiller bounces off the dead sod.
Yeah.
And if you have one of those powered ones, it's running away from you. Okay. And you're chasing all over the place trying to catch the rototiller. And it leaves these big giant clumps. Okay, so this method is actually a no-till method where you kill the lawn off all season, and then in the fall, late fall, you just go out and scatter the seed into the dead sod.
Okay.
And the seed will work its way down into the soil over the winter, and the natural frost-heaving processes will seat that seed down into the soil right where it needs to be for germinating the next spring. And this
is what we call it. Wouldn't need to be rolled or anything either, then?
It wouldn't need to be rolled because it's going to work its way down with the frost heave action of the winter. And you want to do it as late as possible so to minimize any chances of birds getting at the seeds. So before the snow flies, obviously.
Okay. And can you give me a rough idea about the cost, say, per 100 feet, 100 square feet?
100 square feet?
I'm talking about many hundreds, but I'm just narrowing it down.
Okay. It depends upon the seed mix. We have a wide variety of seed mixes. Some have more flowers in them. The flower seed is what's really expensive and to produce. So, but your typical seed mix is going to run you generally around $60 to $70 per 1,000 square feet.
Okay.
Okay. And if you get into like a tenth of an acre, where you're at about 4,400 square feet.
I could probably go to like about close to a half an acre.
Okay. If you're at a quarter acre, you're looking at about $375, $400.
Okay.
And then if you get to a half an acre, you're usually in the $500 to $700 range, again, depending on the mix.
Okay.
There are some more economy-minded mixes where we change the ratio of the flowers to grasses so you have a little more grass than flowers, and the grass seed is proportionally cheaper.
Yeah, okay.
And so if you get into those mixes, you can be in the half acre range of about $300.
Okay. A lot cheaper than $3 a gallon gas.
Yes, for sure.
Okay.
You bet. And you get the long-term benefits not only of the beautiful flowers and grasses, but all the different birds, butterflies, et cetera, that this will attract for you.
You're going to be repeating your address then so I can send
for a catalog? Let's do it again.
Yeah. You can call us at 1-800. Grow Wild.
Grow Wild.
But I hate it when people use those letters because you have to peck around on your phone. So it's 1-800-476-9453. Or you can go to our website and request a catalog. There's a catalog request site location there at www.prairienursery.com. That's PRAIRIE nursery.com.
All right.
Great.
You'll be hearing from me soon.
Excellent. Good luck.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. All right, Tim and East Troy, what's on your mind? Hi.
Hi. I've got about a half-acre prairie that's about 5 years old now. It's getting pretty nice. And I planted one-third of it really heavy with grasses. I got big blue stem in there, little blue stem, and Indian switchgrass in there. And I really want that one to pop more with the grass, and it's kind of getting overtaken by some of the flowers. I was wondering, when should I burn that to really get the grass to come back heavy?
Okay. What kind of flowers are more prevalent in that area?
Mostly like the daisies and the some coneflowers.
Okay. Black-eyed Susans, daisies, coneflowers. Yeah. Okay. What you're going to find here is that the natural progression of a prairie is that you will have a lot of what we call early successional perennials, like the daisies, coneflowers, etc. As your prairie ages, the really long-term species which includes most of your prairie grasses, especially the big bluestem, the switchgrass, Indian grass, and little bluestem. These will tend to solidify their hold on the site. Okay, especially if you planted more grass in that place originally, is that correct?
Yeah, about two-thirds grass to one-third everything
okay.
else.
I would say by year 8 or 9, you should start to see the grasses take over in areas where you planted them more heavily.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now if you want to facilitate that faster, you can do a later spring burn, or if you can't burn, you can just go in there and mow it right down to the ground as a substitute for burning. And by doing that, rather than mid-April to late April like we would normally do, you may want to go in there around mid to late May.
Okay? Oh, okay.
Because most of your prairie grasses are breaking dormancy, usually late April, early May,
mm-hmm.
and a lot of your flowers are going to be ahead of them. So if you mow it or burn it later, like mid-May, you're going to really hammer those flowers. And the, okay. And the grasses are more active in July, August, and September, so you'll tend to favor the grasses.
And how do I get rid of Canadian thistle?
Oh, boy. Oh, boy. Well, you know, you can't pull it because it has roots about 2 feet deep, and then it has lateral roots that run sideways to pop up new Canada thistles. So you can either use a backhoe, which most people don't want to use. Okay, I'm being a little facetious. The other choice is to, there's two ways, and really it comes down to using herbicides. One is to cut it at the base and then dab it with an herbicide that will translocate down into the root. You need to do this not in the spring because the energy of the plant is coming up in the spring and it won't translocate the herbicide down to the roots to kill it. So you have to wait until basically around bloom time to do this, and then it will translocate down into the roots. Or you can use what we call the glove of death, where you put heavy-duty rubber herbicide gloves on, and then you put a cotton glove over one of those gloves, and you can spray the herbicide either Roundup. Some people will go so far as to use broadleaf herbicides, like Weed Be Gone and stuff like that. I hate using that stuff. It's a different class of chemicals from Roundup, but it's very effective, and you just spray it onto the glove. Just put that sprayer right in the glove so you don't have any drift that would, could harm any adjacent plants, and then use that glove just to basically rub the leaves and the stem of the Canada thistle, and then that will only affect the plants that you touch with that glove. So,
yeah, that's been my approach so far, but they're getting ahead of me.
Are they really? Have you found that you've gotten good kill using that method?
Pretty good, yeah.
Okay.
But I just noticed last year I had a huge patch, like right in the center, I'd never noticed before.
Yeah.
About 8 foot in diameter.
It's amazing how fast that stuff can show up and go. And if it's completely taken over, do you have other good plants mixed in there with it?
Yeah, the other stuff's still holding on fairly well.
Okay, good. Then I would use that glove method where it's very selective and you won't harm your adjacent plants. Usually the first treatment will kill 75-80%, and then you'll get it like 20-25% to come back, and you got to go back and get them. But usually by the second treatment, that's pretty much it. That's been my experience. And you may be finding perhaps your concentration isn't sufficient. Canada thistle is a real tough customer.
Okay.
So good luck.
All right, thanks.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. And Ron and Mason, it's your turn now. Hi, Ron.
Yes, good morning. I was wondering, what would you recommend to draw in other pollinators other than with the shortage of honeybees this year for the pollination of apple trees and other fruits and vegetables?
Boy, that's a tough one.
That is a tough one. I'm not an entomologist, so I am not going to be able to address this perhaps as well as you might like. I can tell you this, that it's a great scam, the honeybee business, because we pay these guys to bring their hives in every year, and they take all the honey away. So we pay them to come in, but it's worth it. It really is. And however, I should point out that our number one pollinator is the native bumblebee.
Mm-hmm.
And at our nursery, we have bumblebees everywhere. Now, I don't know what your opportunities are to foster those populations, but by having a diversity of other pollen sources after the spring bloom of the apple trees, you can support high populations of beneficial pollinators. So, and this is where prairies are just fantastic, because you have a wide variety of different flowers that are going to provide just a pantheon of potential nectar sources and pollen sources from spring, summer, and fall, and even into late fall, so that you can support a lot of different pollinators. So I would suggest that you plant one of our mixes that is high on flowers, which is most of them. And we do have a new mix this year called our butterfly mix, which is designed specifically to provide excellent nectar sources for butterflies. But almost any prairie mix with a good variety, like our diverse prairie mix, we have diverse prairie mix for dry soils and for medium soils, it's basically the kitchen sink of different flowers and grasses. Mm. So you create as much habitat, as much pollen source throughout the growing season to support a variety of pollinators that hopefully will be there then for your fruit trees.
The bumblebee is not affected by this?
No.
It isn't?
Well, it hasn't been. At least we haven't found it to be so far.
Hopefully it won't be, because they are amazing creatures and they are such an important pollinator.
Well, luckily I got some growing right in the side of my house.
Excellent. Well, that's a good thing.
Right.
Leave them there.
I will. Yeah. Thank you.
Good luck.
Thanks a lot. Kathy in Madison, hello to you.
Hi. I have a couple questions.
Okay.
I have just a small patch, garden patch that I'd like to, here in Madison, plant some prairie flowers. But we get late afternoon sun, and most of the prairie plants labels talk about full sun. So what would be some good suggestions for
Okay. What kind of soil do you have?
Little clay.
Little clay? Okay, so it's going to tend to be pretty damp in the spring or stay cool in the spring.
Yes.
How much sun do you get? Do you get at least a half a day of full sun?
Yes, I think so.
Okay. If you get at least a half a day of full sun.
Mm-hmm.
Then you can grow just about any prairie plant.
Okay.
And you also have the benefit of being on the west side of the house, you said?
Well, it's kind of in the middle of a lot.
Okay. So
it's being shaded by shade from garage and a spirea and a few other things.
Okay. Do you get more afternoon sun or more?
More morning.
More morning sun. Okay.
Right.
Your morning sun is cooler
than
the afternoon sun. And this is an interesting thing. You can grow more woodland type plants on the east side of a house than you can on the west side, because in the morning you have the dew typically on the plants, and so the plants will stay cool until the sun warms up and removes the dew, so the actual plant leaf temperature stays cooler because the dew, the heat of vaporization is required to melt, excuse me, see, I'm still thinking winter, to evaporate that dew will keep the plants cooler, so you can grow cooler-loving plants on the east side. On the west side, you can grow plants that like it hotter. If you still have at least a half a day of full sun and good drainage, you should be okay.
Okay.
But there are a number of woodland-type plants that you can grow on the east side of the house, like columbine. Okay. And you can push a lot of the woodland plants into the sun if they only get a half a day of sun.
Okay.
And if they get that cool morning sun.
Now, I've tried purple coneflower, and they're growing, but they don't stand up very straight. You know, they kind of fall over. Does that mean they're not getting enough sun?
It could be many different things. It could be not enough sun. It could be too much nitrogen.
Oh, okay.
Because the balance between nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium, excess nitrogen will make the plants grow more stems and leaves. Phosphorus tends to grow more roots and flowers. So you may have a potential nutrient imbalance in your soil.
Oh.
But if they're long and leggy,
okay,
that's probably lack of sun. But the purple coneflower is a partial shade plant.
Okay.
So it typically would be expected to do well in the conditions you described.
Okay.
All right.
I also have another question. We have a cottage up in northern Oconto County, and it's in the woods, but I do have some open areas. I'd like to plant some indigenous plants. Do you have some of those there in your nursery?
Oh, yes, absolutely.
That would be appropriate for that area.
Oh, what kind of soil do you have there? That's pretty sandy soil?
Yes.
Yeah, okay, typical of Oconto County.
Right.
Yeah, if you pick plants that are hardy to Zone 4 and all of our hardiness zones are listed in every one of our plant descriptions, that will grow in a sandy soil and sun, you should have very good results.
Okay, and they're native plants or not?
If they are not native, they are listed. We do have some plants, particularly a few woodland plants from farther east, from like the Appalachians, because they're just some really cool plants, and we do have customers out in that area that requested them.
But you do list that they're indigenous or native or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
If it doesn't say that it's from, you know, the Smoky Mountains or from Ohio or something like that, then it's indigenous to Wisconsin.
Great. Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. And let's go to Nick in Green Bay next. Hi, Nick.
I've got a small problem. I've got about 50 feet of woods in my backyard. I live in Green Bay.
Yep.
And we got a creek that runs back there. Well, with the rain and the snow that we've had, it just flooded my whole backyard. And the ground is so saturated that even my 60-pound black lab sinks.
Oh, my God.
And I was wondering, what can I do to stiffen this up? I mean, I tried to go back there to put some birdhouses up, and my wife told me I couldn't come in the house because my shoes were full of mud.
Let me ask you this. What is growing there right now? Is this all wooded?
It's all wooded. There's some bushes with thorns on there. I found that out the hard way. I walked through them.
Buckthorn? Sounds like buckthorn, yeah.
Yeah, and the grass is, like I said, there's grass growing there up to the woods, but it's just so saturated that the dog won't even go on there to do anything.
Well, now, is this just a spring thing? Is this unusual? Have you lived there for a while to be able to observe this?
I lived there 3 months now.
Okay, so you don't know if this is an annual event or if it's unusual this year.
No, I'm not sure.
Okay, but you haven't had, like, extraordinary rain or snow, so this is probably a pretty typical event. Okay, so the first thing to do is to evaluate what your overstory trees are.
Okay.
Okay, and how much sun, if any, is coming down through those trees. And then to look at what your understory shrub layer may be.
All right.
And it sounds, by your description, that you probably have buckthorn, which is an extremely invasive, non-native shrub.
Oh, okay.
And typically, it's one of the reasons it's probably very muddy is because buckthorn casts such a heavy shade that not a lot of plants can grow underneath it. And this
if I remove that, will it come back, or is it pretty hard to get rid of?
It's pretty tough to get rid of, but we have ways to handle this.
Because the whole backyard is filled with it. Even the neighbors have it.
Yeah, and it's probably, what is it, like anywhere from 10 to 20 feet high?
Yep, exactly, yeah. And that thing, like I said, I found out the hard way. I was putting up a bird feeder.
Oh.
I was like, oh, wait, there's thorns on this thing.
Yeah, and you get those thorns, and they will sit in there, and they almost have a poison on them or something.
Yeah.
They hurt quite a bit. What you can do to get rid of buckthorn is, if it's a small plant, you can pull it out by the roots.
Okay.
But when but that's really, if it's a heavy soil, that's a lot of hard work. I have
this is a very big tree.
Okay, yeah. So it's probably 3, 4, or 5 inches in diameter.
Easy. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So they're mature. Okay. Now I'm assuming it's buckthorn. You want to make sure and get a positive identification before you go kill anything.
Okay. Yeah.
But what you can do when you have large buckthorn like this, and this is what the Nature Conservancy does, this is what I do, this is what most restorationists do, is you go in there with a chainsaw. And you cut it down, usually in the fall or the winter. This does not work this time of year because you want to be at the time of year when the plant is sending its nutrients down into the roots. Right now, the buckthorn have just started to send their sap up into the leaves and stems, and so you're not going to get translocation when you herbicide it. You cut it with your chainsaw, and immediately after cutting, you treat the cambium, which is the outer ring of the tree or shrub.
Okay.
That's the only true living part of the plant, and that's where the transportation of nutrients and water occurs.
Okay.
You just treat that outer ring about a half an inch around on the very outside. You can put Roundup or brush-killing herbicide on it in the fall or the winter. And when
Does that work in the winter?
It works in the winter. I do it. I was doing it.
I'm surprised because I thought the temperatures needed to be up to 50 degrees.
Nope. I've gone out well below freezing and done this. Well, you have to be careful. The herbicide doesn't freeze up on you. But, you know.
Okay.
But you don't want to be too cold. But I was just out 2 weeks ago, and just before the sap started to flow. And buckthorn is one of the fairly early ones to come. But usually I can do it until the end of March. And fall is the best. After the leaves come off, it's easier because you don't have all the leaves in your way. And this will kill the roots, but this is only half the battle. And this is one of the mistakes people make. What happens with all those buckthorn? What have they been doing for years and years? They've been making seeds. Now you have a seed bank in the soil. If you then go in and say, oh, I killed all the buckthorn after I cut them down and treated them. I killed all the buckthorn. No, you're going to have all these seedlings that are going to germinate, and they can germinate in a veritable plethora. I mean, like a carpet. So now what do you do? If you have a desirable ground layer in there of native flowers, sedges, grasses, you want to be really careful. In fact, I have areas on my property. I go in and I hand-pick those dang seedlings out.
Okay.
Talk about therapy, man. Oh, my God. You don't have anything to do on Sunday afternoon? Need to chill out? Hey, go pick buckthorn seedlings. Oh, boy, I tell you, it's like, whew.
No, hypothetically, I get rid of this bush. What can I replace it that would promote wildlife? Because I got tons of birds that sit in there.
Okay, you can look at some native shrubs.
Okay.
Like some of your dogwoods and viburnums are really good. The dogwoods are the best, one of the very best. And what they call alternate leaf dogwood or pagoda dogwood, Cornus alternifolia, which grows in a richer type soil. And I'm assuming you have a pretty good soil.
Yeah.
Okay. And it likes a semi-shaded understory situation. That's a fantastic plant. And then some of your viburnums will also grow in a shaded situation.
Will they take that wet that comes
for a couple of weeks every year?
The Cornus alternifolia is actually adjacent to a floodplain type plant. It will,
okay.
And most of your viburnums, you want to, there's a number to choose from, but most of them will take it pretty damp too. I'm assuming it's only seasonal flooding.
Yeah.
And it won't, yeah. won't be something that's going to be wet all year round.
Okay.
Okay, but yeah, Cornus alternifolia will take quite a bit of moisture. In fact, it doesn't do well on dry sites. It prefers kind of what we call a wet mesic
okay.
site, mesic being medium. So this is between wet and medium is where it really
okay.
really does best.
Yeah, the only good thing about these bushes is the birds just love it.
The birds do love it, and that's one of the reasons people planted them, is
yeah.
they planted them not just for horticultural purposes, but because the birds do like the seeds, but that's the big problem is then the birds spread the seeds all over the place.
Oh, okay. All yeah, right. Well, thank you very much.
Yep.
Good luck.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Neil Diebel, prairie ecologist and president of Prairie Nursery of Westfield, Wisconsin, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking prairie plants today in our Wisconsin landscape with Neil Diebel of Prairie Nursery in Westfield, Wisconsin. Thanks for listening in. Lots of callers online, so we'll go right back to the phones and to Connie in Arcadia. Connie, hello.
Hi. You gave a really good description of how to prepare the land using Roundup. I'm assuming it would be a lot harder, but I'd be interested in what you'd do if you didn't want to use Roundup.
You have a number of choices on that, Connie. Is this a large area or a small area?
I've got a pretty big yard.
Okay. If it's a small area, you can smother it, and you can use black plastic, or you can maybe go to the neighborhood farmer after he's done with his on-ground silage and get some of that white plastic and put that down, and that will typically smother things. And if you have a lawn, a good lawn without any weeds in it, usually a couple months will do it.
Okay.
If you have all kinds of weeds or it's just a weedy old patch, then you need to smother that for an entire growing season starting from early spring all the way into the fall, and that will kill most weeds. And a couple of weeds that typically can survive that are good old Canada thistle and bindweed, because they have mm-hmm. these root reserves that allow them to stay dormant for an extended period of time, and those you may have to keep smothered for 2 years.
Oh, okay.
Oh, it's unbelievable. Yeah.
Okay.
And if you don't...
I don't think we have those.
Okay, good. You don't want them.
No, you don't want them.
You don't want them. Those are noxious weeds.
Yeah.
Or you can just put down, like, newspaper and then lawn clippings over that, or cardboard and lawn clippings. On larger areas, you can use deep tillage, repeated deep tillage, which will kill most weeds. Again, exceptions are things like Canada thistle and bindweed, which just do not respond to this. But you deep tillage meaning 6, 7, 8 inches, and you just keep harassing the roots until about every 3 to 4 weeks. You just go in and till, and you eventually will deplete the root reserves of the weeds, grasses, etc., until you have nothing growing there. The problem with this method is every time you till, what do you bring up?
More seeds.
You bring up weed seeds. So it's kind of self-defeating. You'll kill the perennial existing vegetation with this if you do it for a year. Usually a year, every 3, 4 weeks, we'll do it for most species, including quackgrass, will usually be killed. But now you're talking April, May, June, July. I mean, I've done this. Whoa, man,
yeah.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
It's a commitment, let me tell you.
Okay.
And if you're on a slope, then you have issues with erosion. This is not a good method for slopes because every time you till, you're going to open that soil up and it can wash away on you, which is really self-defeating.
And you have to bite the bullet and do Roundup anyway.
Well, another choice is you can use organic smother crops. And this is what farmers used to use before the advent of herbicides, is they used smother crops to control primarily weeds like quackgrass.
Uh-huh.
And this is using a buckwheat, winter wheat rotation, where you go in usually in mid-June, late June, after any danger of frost has passed, and you plant buckwheat. You till the ground up, okay, plow it, till it, whatever, so you have a proper seedbed, and plant buckwheat. This is a fast-growing annual crop. It forms a really dense canopy, which basically shades the soil surface where the weeds would grow.
Uh-huh.
Before the buckwheat makes seeds, and it's, I cannot stress enough, before the buckwheat makes seeds, you cut it down, and then you till it in as a green manure crop, okay, which adds organic matter to the soil. You wait a few weeks for that to break down so you don't have any ammonia buildup or anything, and then you plant winter wheat, which would usually be sometime mid-September to mid-October. And the winter wheat will then grow over the winter, hold the soil, and add more organic matter. And then in the spring, when the winter wheat gets pretty tall before it heads out, you cut it down again and green manure that in. And then in June, plant another crop of buckwheat. So it's a two-year process where you use buckwheat, winter wheat, buckwheat. And this will smother most weeds.
Okay.
Okay, the combination of the tillage and the smother crops will...
It's just a longer process.
It's a longer process. But you know, when we have old field situations where we have weedy grasses and stuff, the best method for that is to spray it with herbicides for 2 years in a row.
Okay.
Okay, when you have lots of weeds. 1 year will typically kill the perennials, but then you have all the weed seeds in the soil. And so we'll spray it a second year for all those weed seeds to germinate before we go in and hopefully use a no-till method to seed, because we don't want to till after all this preparation. We don't want to till it and bring up more weed seeds.
Then I have another question. I've got a really steep bank on the east side of my house. It's maybe, 15 feet from the house.
Okay.
And it's just full of weeds.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd really like to plant something pretty there.
Mm-hmm.
What would you use the Roundup, I mean, if that's what I was going to do, or the smother it first?
On a site, how big is the area? Is it just a small area?
No, it's about 50 feet.
50 by?
By, 8-10 feet tall.
Oh, okay.
50 by 10.
That's not too bad. You can smother that. One of the advantages of smothering on a steep slope is that you cover the soil so it doesn't erode.
Yeah.
Whereas if you go out there and start spraying it with Roundup, it kills the weeds. And typically, if you have lots of thick grasses growing there, you can kill that for one growing season with Roundup and leave it exposed, and the roots, the dead roots, will hold that soil in place, assuming you have a solid cover.
Mm-hmm.
And then you could go in either the next spring and put in transplants, or assuming everything is killed, you could put the seed down that fall, as we talked about earlier in the show, where you just scatter the seed over the dead, weedy area. But you want to make doggone sure that everything is dead before you plant, or else you're going to be right back where you started.
Okay.
But smothering will allow you to cover the soil and protect it from erosion, and you just do that all year, and then you could come in the next spring and put in your transplants, or you could again go in that fall and put in seeds.
Okay.
Okay.
Very good. Thanks.
Thanks, Connie. And Paula in Ashland, your turn. Hi, Paula.
Hi. I have what has been used as a vegetable garden for many years. So the soil is very good. And last fall, all the weeds were pulled manually, and there's straw over it all winter.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not going to be using it as a vegetable garden anymore, and I would like to start... that butterfly seed thing, because I'd like to attract butterflies.
Sure.
It was till last fall before the straw was put on it. And I can't remember whether my son was using every fall or every spring. We put, I think it was nitrogen, but I'm not really sure. So I imagine I would have to have my soil tested, because you said something about if it had too much nitrogen. It gets sun all day. It's really beautiful soil, but I don't want to use it for that. I want something that I don't have to, take care of, the time.
That's a perfect candidate because you've got the weeds controlled.
Yeah.
It has a history of being managed for hopefully no weeds, basically, right, as a
vegetable
garden? Yeah. That is a perfect candidate for converting to a prairie. And because it's, I assume it's well-drained, is that correct?
Yes.
Yeah, so you have a good rich soil in a well-drained situation.
Yes.
Then you would want to use a medium soil mix. And
medium
there are many
soil
to choose from. There's short, there's tall, there's diverse, there's butterfly mix for medium soils. Whatever's going to meet your design criteria.
Uh-huh.
And that's a perfect situation for planting a prairie mix.
Well, the straw is still on it. How would I distribute the seed?
Oh, okay. You could... How thick is the straw?
The soil?
The straw.
Oh, it's just over the top,
A couple inches?
I'd say, yeah.
Can you see the soil at all?
I don't know. I haven't looked lately.
It's been covered with snow.
Yeah.
One thing you can do, this is unusual, but this is there's a method called frost seeding.
Oh?
Where it,
frost?
Yes, F-R-O-S-T.
Yeah.
Okay, and this is?
Seeding?
Seeding.
Seeding,
yes,
yeah.
It's called frost seeding. And you may still, it may not be too late for you up there, because what you can do is, just like in the fall where you scatter the seed over the soil, if you're going to have enough freezing cold nights, if you were to go out and put that seed down right away.
Over the straw?
Yep.
Oh.
And it will work its way down. I'm assuming the straw is not real thick.
No, I don't think so.
And if you can, the seed will kind of fall down between the straw.
Yeah.
And then if you get enough freezing nights, that seed is going to work its way down into the soil.
Well, I'm hoping we're not going to have more freezing weather.
But you're in Ashland, so give it up. You got another month of cold, honey. Oh, yeah, I know what goes on. I used to spend a lot of time up in Ashland, and you're going to have frost for another month, right? You know, nobody wants it. But anyway, that is one method you can use. Can you water this area at all?
Oh, yeah, I can. It's not... About it's away from my house,
uh-huh.
and it's just no trees hanging over.
Okay.
It's just all evergreens. Mm-hmm. I planted maybe a couple dozen evergreens, but they're away and they don't shade. So.
Okay. Well, you have two choices. You can go and rake the straw off, and then scatter your seed and rake it in lightly.
Oh.
Okay. That's a little more guaranteed.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
Or you can scatter it over the straw and let it work its way in. And then you can start watering it. And the combination of regular watering will keep the soil moist, and the straw over the surface of the soil will also retain moisture. So you'll have perfect germination conditions, and even seed that's on the surface of the soil will typically germinate, even if it isn't worked down into the soil. In fact, I threw a bunch of extra seed on some ground late June on some sand that was... it was an area that was ready, and I threw it in it, and I got germination like you wouldn't believe because it rained for 3 days right after that. And I got prairie flowers and prairie grasses just from throwing the seed on the ground in June, which is not recommended. But wow, did I get lucky. So this method can work for you by just scattering it over the straw as long as the seed's going to work its way through the straw into the soil.
And thanks for calling in. Neil, thank you so much.
Thank you, Larry. It's always a pleasure.
And again, your website is prairienursery.com.
That's correct.
And what's your 800 number?
800-476-9453 or 800-GROW-WILD.
Thanks, Neil.
Thank you, Larry.
Look forward to your next visit. Neil Diebel, our guest, who is president of the Prairie Nursery of Westfield, Wisconsin. Coming up, we'll be talking mulch here on the Ideas Network. I turn our attention now to the Olbrich Botanical Gardens and Garden Talk topic on mulch. Jeff Epping, my guest now, director of horticulture of Olbrich Botanical Gardens, located on Madison's east side. Olbrich Botanical Gardens is the 2005 winner of the American Association of Botanic Gardens and Arboretas Award of Garden Excellence. That is about as good as you can get. It reflects the best design and most horticulturally outstanding displays, gardens that reflect the regional environment, environmentally friendly gardening practices, commitment to plant collections, all kinds of things. And it's really great to have an award like this come to Wisconsin and to the Olbrich Botanic Garden. So we're really pleased to have Jeff on with us today. And we're going to zero in a little bit today with Jeff on mulch, because mulch, a lot of good things about mulch.
You bet there are. It's one of the best things you can do for your garden. I can say that bar none. I mean, there's a lot of cultural practices, but you're going to have a lot of work ahead of you and put a lot more resource, be it time, energy through water, fertilization, all those things, unless you use a good mulch.
Yeah, unless you use a good... What is a good mulch?
Well, one of the things that we've tried to do over the past several years, and actually this started probably 10 years ago, we used to buy mulch in from northern Wisconsin. We have shredded hardwood mulch, and now you see mulch coming from all over the United States, you know, pine straw and cedar chips. And you know, we didn't think that was a very sustainable or environmentally friendly thing to do. Let's try to find something local that we can use. And after a trip I took to Ohio and saw a small garden in Mansfield, Ohio, called Kingwood Center, beautiful estate garden. And they were just bringing in leaves from the city and running mm-hmm. them through a real primitive manure spreader, the old kind that kind of shoots mm-hmm. it out the back. And I thought, you know, we can maybe do something like that. And so we found these newfangled machines that shred up the leaves real good on a large scale and take a little energy to do that. But all the leaves that we use for the mulch come from the city of Madison. They come yeah. from the trees that are all around us. And so why not use a resource that is right here available to us and really available to not only Olbrich, but everybody. rather than have the city haul away all your leaves. You know, you can compost on a small scale. Some of us don't maybe have the physical means or the space to do that. So we're happy to provide that that product for them at the garden. And like I say, something we've used for over 10 years. And
really good results, obviously.
Oh, excellent results. And it's a leaf mulch rather than a hardwood mulch. So it breaks down quicker, which in one way creates a little more work for you, but in others is much better for the soil. It breaks down into materials that the plants can then use and uptake and grow much better. So we want a mulch that, if you can find something locally, which we all can, it's just a matter of how available it is and might take a little time to do that, to find what you might have locally. But we want, you know, the soils to be covered for many reasons. One, it retains moisture in the soil, as probably is pretty obvious. It adds nutrients. It cools the soil, which is important to a lot of plants, especially things like birch in our area, which really appreciate a cooler root zone. And weeds. You know, weeding is a constant chore in the garden. And if you leave your beds open, every weed seed that's in there will be available to germinate and for you to pull on an endless basis.
You know, I had a garden in a previous place where I lived. It was about 60 feet long, maybe 15 feet wide. And we had a lot of trees. And my parents lived not that far away, and they had a bunch of trees. And I used leaves in that garden mulch every year, and it was great. The amount of work I had to do for weeding was low. The weeds or the leaves sort of disintegrated or worked itself into the soil. It was wonderful.
Exactly, and that's what you want. You want that leaf mulch to break down on an annual basis and enrich those soils to make your soil structure even better. Organic matter is a huge part of a healthy soil, and this just the earthworms and other microorganisms and so just work it all down in, and you'll be shocked at over just a few years at how rich your top couple inches become, and then as time goes by it gets deeper and deeper and better, and the plants just thrive.
Jeff Epping, our guest today from the Olbrich Botanical Gardens, where he's director of horticulture. If you have a question for him as we move along here, give us a call. I haven't given that number yet. Let me do it right now. 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. In the Madison area, reach us at 263-1890. 263-1890. Give us a call. And you have a sale of your leaf mulch coming up. Not this weekend, but the following weekend.
That's correct. We process the leaves that we talked about. The City of Madison Streets Department brings them over in truckloads in the fall, where they sit in large piles and begin the decomposition process. Then we run them through these shredders to break them down even further. And then the mulch is available both in a bagged form that we do right on site with volunteer crews, or you can get it in bulk. If you came with a pickup truck on certain days, we'll actually load it into your truck. And it's all based, boy, I should know this, how many bags we have. It's a tremendous amount. I don't know, several thousand, 5,000, 6,000. And so the sale goes until we run out. And the first year we did this, when we proposed it, we had lots of sort of snickers about, oh, you're going to sell this stuff that people, give you off their trees, and now you're going to sell it back to them. And we said, well, in a different form.
Right.
And the response was so overwhelming, we ran out of mulch in the first couple days and didn't have any for the second day sale. But now we know about what we can sell, and we'll have plenty on hand.
Oh, that's one. And how big are the bags?
They are, that's a good question. They're bags, they're $6 a bag. Each bag will cover about 35 square feet in your garden. That's a good way to think about it. And you put it on about 3 to 4 inches thick or so.
So they're about $6. That's pretty cheap for 35 square feet.
It is. It really, and like I say, it's a local product. It's something that we can feel good about putting on our gardens in an environmental way, rather than buying mulch that's coming in from all over the country and all that energy that goes into it just to get it here. Not to mention the other things. So, it's a great product.
Well, let's take some calls. Pat and Maze and Maney, I believe you're up. Pat, hi. Thank you for calling.
Thank you. I'm wondering if you can tell me anything about a new product I've seen on the market that's a blended mushroom mulch. And is that good for some things and not others, or what exactly can you tell me?
Well, that's a good question. Again, there's many of the mulches that are available are byproducts of industry. And that mushroom compost or mulch that you're talking about is the growing medium for mushroom farms. It generally, has some type of straw in it, and oftentimes horse manure, or, there may be other things. I'm not a mycologist. I won't admit to it. But in general, it's pretty good stuff, and something that I think it would work out well for you. Again, if there's mushroom farms in the area, you might investigate that rather than buying some material that's, coming in from another part of the country. So it's something to look into. But it's a composted manure with a organic base. So
does it have any advantage?
Again, it's an organic matter. It's got manure. It's got those. It's another form of mulch, like ours, that I think will work well for you. I have one caution for you, and this is I'm not sure about it being in the mushroom compost, but in the past, I have had some experience using horse manure, composted horse manure. Many barns now are using wood shavings, again, a byproduct from the lumber industry, and wood shavings mixed in with the horse manure. If you use that product, you have to be very careful about not tilling that product into the soil, because wood is very high in carbon, and to break down that carbon, you need nitrogen, and that's what your plants want. And if you work it in the soil, all the microorganisms will tie up. The nitrogen will be tied up in the decomposition process that they need to break down the carbon. And I did that once in my home garden. It took me 3 years to get the soil back to the point where it was originally. So I learned my lesson the hard way, and one I'll never forget.
Thanks
so
very
don't,
much.
Don't make that
very
mistake.
Informative.
Yeah, thanks, Pat. Bob, Oak Creek, your turn. Hi, Bob.
Hi, I hope this isn't going to be something that is too far away from what you're doing. I just rebuilt a window box. It's about 9 feet long, and it's about 18 inches wide, but I put a copper bottom on it, wooden sides, copper sheet bottom. Am I going to regret this and have to throw it away?
No, I don't think so. In fact, copper can, copper leachate off of a copper roof actually can be somewhat toxic to roots. However, you indicate you only have it on the bottom of that
It'll pot. Be about 7 inches deep.
Yeah, it'll probably just, the leachate will, if you have drainage holes, which you should, on the bottom, that should just go right out the bottom. So I don't think you'll have a problem with it. In fact, the nursery industry is now using compounds with copper oxides in them, and they paint the insides of the pots. And so when the roots hit the edge of the pot, the tips die, and then they branch back farther into the rooting media to get a very much better root system on plants that they sell. So I don't think you'll have a problem with that.
Okay.
Great. No, I'm going to load it up with mulch and other materials. Hope it grows.
And there you go.
Thanks, Bob. Mike and Madison, your turn. Hi, Mike.
Hi, good afternoon. Question about whether or not cocoa bean mulch is more beneficial. And then, of course, the same question that seems to come up every year is the weed barrier underneath the mulch. And then my third question is, what about using grass clippings?
Okay, that's good. All good questions. The first, cocoa beans. When I came to the garden about 12 years ago, we sold cocoa beans as a mulch, and did so for quite a while. Again, byproduct from the chocolate industry. And personally, I don't think they make a great mulch for the fact that they are very high in carbon, don't break down very well, and so don't enrich the soil to any great degree. In fact, I recall, you know, we're in a couple beds where we just keep adding it every year, and we were having problems with some of these plants rotting. Well, once you got in the bed and started digging down a little, mm-hmm. we had, you know, 6-8 inches of this cocoa bean mulch, which would retain too much moisture within the mulch, and sometimes create almost an impenetrable barrier for the water to go through the mulch and reach the soil where you want it. And that caused all sorts of rotting problems and such. So personally, I don't believe in using cocoa bean mulch. If you want to use it in some flower beds for just a nice backdrop, you can. But don't put it on too thick. You know, a couple inches is all you need. And then you might consider raking off old mulch that's getting thick but not looking good. And you don't want to, you know, you want to put fresh on. You know, put that in the compost pile. And it will break down over a long period of time.
Then the weed barrier?
Well, weed barrier, you know, that's these synthetic fabrics. Again, not a big believer in them for most plants because what they do is create a barrier between the organic mulches that you apply in the soil. So they cannot get incorporated into the soil and enrich the soil. And I've seen, again, where that mulch layer on top of the fabric gets deeper and deeper and deeper. And the root systems of the plants like that better than they do underneath the fabric because there's not enough oxygen, there's not enough water down there. Not enough nutrients down there, and they root then above the fabric, which then creates a very shallow root system, which is very subject to drought if we have a severe drought, and it's very subject to cold temperature extremes. If we have a very cold winter where we have no snow cover, those roots can actually be damaged. So for an organic mulch, I don't recommend it. Now, for certain plants like junipers, which like a very dry crown and dry conditions, that's what they're adapted to in nature, oftentimes the best mulch to use on them is a rock mulch, be it, you know, some type of stone. Then a fabric barrier is okay because you don't have an organic material above it. And any needles that fall, then you might consider, you know, cleaning those out a little bit each season so you don't build up an organic layer. And junipers by nature are very drought tolerant, so they can handle those warmer extreme conditions. So.
And then grass clippings as a mulch?
Grass clippings, if you don't put them on too thick, they're okay. I would just as soon put them in my compost pile, mix them in or mix them with my compost a little bit and then put them down. If you get them too thick, again, they kind of mat together and they anaerobically decompose. If you've ever smelled grass clippings that have done that, they're awful. So they're okay to use, but just put them on a thin layer. And then, you know, you have this whole issue with if the grass clippings are from a lawn that was heavily, you know, applied with a herbicide or something, you might actually find some problems if you would use it in like a vegetable garden or tomatoes are very sensitive to 2,4-D, which is a common lawn herbicide. So, you know, if you have that situation, you'd be better off to compost them first.
All right. Thanks a lot, Mike. And Judy in Round Lake, Illinois, your turn. Hi, Judy.
Hi. Are you guys? Welcome to spring.
Yeah.
I have a question about my vegetable garden. I want to use newspaper after I get my garden planted and then start putting newspaper down and putting my grass clippings on top of that.
For a mulch.
For a mulch, yes, definitely.
I'll be honest, I don't have experience doing that. I've read articles and seen recommendations that can be done. I would guess that you don't want to put the newspaper layer to be too awfully thick. Again, I think it would tend to shed the water off a little more. But, a thinner layer with the grass, you know, thin layer of grass clippings, I think would probably work quite well.
2-3 sheets, maybe?
I would think that would probably be about right.
Last year I ran out of mulch because I have a lawnmower that bags everything. And I use everything, you know, but in the summer, I run out of mulch because, especially if we have a drought where nothing's growing, I have nothing to put on.
Right, right. Well, grass clippings by nature have a lot of nitrogen in them, so they break down much quicker than like a leaf mulch or a wood mulch.
Yeah, very
would.
Fast.
Yep, yep. Yep.
Okay.
Okay.
Thanks, Judy. Thanks very much for coming. Oh, and by the way, you could drive up to Madison the weekend after next and purchase some of that mulch, and you get that bag mulch that you're selling, that'll stay until summer.
Oh, yeah, you bet. I just put it in a shady shady spot or in your garage, and no problem. Just keep it dry.
All right, Judy, thank you very much. And Zoe and Madison, hi to you.
Hi. I'm going to be purchasing some of that wonderful leaf mulch. And we recently purchased a house, and we had all kinds of gardens already there. And it has mulch already on the gardens. And I'm wondering, do we need to pull that hardwood mulch off before we put the leaf mulch on top of it?
That's a good question. It's hard to answer without knowing how thick that is. But I would say no. What if it's a thin layer, which it probably is if it's been around for a year or two, you can just apply right over the top. If it's thin in some areas, thick in others, you might just take a rake and thin it all out a little bit evenly before you put the mulch down. You know, the leaf mulch is especially nice for beds where you are using perennials, annuals, that sort of thing, because it's a nice fine mulch. It's easy to work with. It forms a great backdrop for flowers to be seen against because it's sort of a chocolate brown color. Mm. You know, especially we try to get ours down early in our bulb beds, or even last fall in our bulb beds, because when those newly emerging bulbs come up, the colors pop so much better against that dark background. So if you had a lot of the wood mulch, I mean, maybe 2 to 3 inches, you might just rake that back around your shrubs more and just use it around that, and then apply the leaf mulch in the foreground of your beds. That would be another thing you could do.
Okay. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks for calling. And Molly and Madison, hi to you.
Yeah, hi. I've had a problem before with a leaf mulch that's, you know, decomposed, but it's had a lot of weed seeds in it. And I'm wondering if that's normally a problem or if just this certain batch.
No, I wouldn't say it would normally be a problem. It would be an issue of where those leaves are stored before they're processed or how long they've been around. You know, ours come in the fall. Plants are already dormant. We have it in an area that there's not a lot of weed seed infiltration at all, and then it's ground and sold. And then the next year we have a fresh batch of leaves that we use it again.
As a general rule, no.
Okay. And then the hardwood double shredded mulch, does that break down, or is that what you're saying, like wood doesn't break down easily?
No, it breaks down, but it takes much longer to do so, and because of that, it doesn't have the soil building value that a leaf mulch like we're using would.
Even when double shredded.
Right. So it still takes longer to break down. Right. And that's, you know, in big gardens where you have lots of shrubs and trees,
it's a good
you
thing.
Know, it's still a good thing. Right, right. And the leaf mulch is best for smaller gardens or flower type gardens. And even at Old Brick, in our big mulched beds where it's just trees and shrubs, we use hardwood mulch from the city of Madison again, that they when they harvest their trees, they shred them, and we get that for again free from them, and that's available in Madison for the public as well.
Thanks very much for calling. And Jeff, as we get over to your sale a week Saturday after next, and it's on the 21st, right? Friday, April 20th, and Saturday, April 21st, those 2 days.
That's right. 2 to 6 on the 20th and 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. on Saturday, the 21st.
And then what else can we see in the gardens this time of year?
Well, snow.
Yeah. Right,
that's the trouble. But I think it'll be melting off. We have a lot of minor bulbs coming up. Our meadow has over 20,000 bulbs scattered throughout it that have been in bloom already. Some of the vernal witch hazels, hellebores, those sorts of things. Forsythia, magnolias will be coming along pretty soon, along with the crabs and lilacs. You know, it's all going to come. I still am a believer that we will have spring.
Thanks very much. And your website is olbrich.org, isn't it?
That is right.
O-L-B-R-I-C-H. So it's like Olbrich.
Yeah, O-L-B-R-I-C-H. That's right.
.org. Jeff Epping, Director of Horticulture at Olbrich Botanical Gardens, located on Madison's east side at 3330 Atwood Avenue. And the sale, the leaf mulch sale, is Friday the 20th and Saturday the 21st. Friday from 2 to 6 and Saturday from 9 to 1 p.m. or until supplies last. Thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store.